Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Critters in Space and Training Astronauts. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marion Summerall, in for Brendan Byrne. NASA has worked with animals to research how they could live in space successfully for generations. From fruit flies to water bears, scientists have learned a lot about how biological processes react to microgravity and how that might apply to humans. We'll speak with NASA's Sharmila Patacharya about the animals launching into orbit. Then, how do you prepare humans for spaceflight? We'll speak with Christy Keeler, a member of the Astronaut Strength, Conditioning, and Rehabilitation Group, about how the astronauts prepare their bodies for space travel. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? There have been quite a few animals who have been to space over the past decades. Sharmila Patacharya is a program scientist for the Space Biology, Biological, and Physical Sciences Division at NASA, and she is working with these animals to see how organisms react to microgravity environments and what they might teach us about long-duration spaceflight. Sharmila, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marion.
Today we're talking about, animals in space. So first, tell me a little bit about your background and how you found yourself working in space biology.
So I'm a molecular biologist by training. As it may surprise a lot of people, when I started my career in science, I just loved science, but I wasn't thinking NASA or anything specific. And then actually I was doing my postdoctoral research at Stanford University, which is down the hall from NASA's Ames Research Center. And as I am finishing my, writing a particular paper, and I was just browsing through the newspaper, and there was NASA looking for a PhD scientist who worked with fruit flies and yeast systems, which is what I had done my PhD and my postdoctoral research in. And so I just, looked at that ad. I was like, this has my name all over it. Got to apply. And then one thing led to another. And so then now I've been at NASA almost 25 years.
And you said fruit flies. I heard you correctly, right?
You did. You did indeed.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. So can we talk about some of the coolest animals that, NASA has sent or that you've personally worked with?
So, for example, as we just talked about, fruit flies has been one model system that I have worked with and NASA has sent up to space. In fact, it's interesting that I believe the very first biological organism that was sent into space and then shown to survive and come back safely was actually Drosophila was the fruit fly back in 1947. NASA specifically uses a variety of different systems to do biology experiments. For example, some of the standard research organisms used on Earth, we talked about fruit flies. Worms are another one, called C. elegans. Another one is, for example, the rodent, so rats and mice. Yeast is another one, which surprises a lot of people because they're these single cell systems, but their cellular structure is actually very similar to what are called eukaryotic organisms like ourselves. And so a lot of very good research can be done with yeast cells. So that's been another model that NASA and others have used. Then there are some other ones, for example, the tardigrade, which is this, very robust system that even on Earth, and these tardigrades, actually, they're called water bears. They're these tiny, almost microscopic creatures, and you see pictures of them, they really look like bears. And they are very robust, so they can withstand, high radiation environments. They can withstand a lot of drought, very dehydrated conditions, extremes in temperature. And so one of the things, for example, that folks are interested in using it in space is to understand, how is this organism so robust in the face of so many environmental extreme conditions? And what can we learn from them? And what can we use from those organisms to actually harness and use to our benefit, you know, for future space exploration. So you can see from this, it's a very wide panel of systems. And then not to mention, there are cell systems where it's not a full organism or an animal, but it's an organ system or a tissue system that can mimic a particular set of, for example, human tissues without having to do the experiment on humans or, you know, in any other way. These are called in vitro studies, but these are also very powerful and we can work with those systems as well.
Let's go back for a second and talk about, so these cells can mimic like a human organ?
Exactly. So in fact, you know, something called 3D tissues or organoids, these are systems that are actually getting increasingly popular and are actually being used on Earth as well to do tests on different pharmaceutical candidates. So, you know, different drugs that you might want to use on humans for particular disease modalities, you can use some of these surrogates, if you please, you know, human surrogates in a tissue culture dish, essentially, that mimic some aspect of human physiology. And you can use those to do tests in space as well as on the ground.
I know that, you know, how we house humans in space, but how do we house these organisms, these live creatures, insects and cells?
The amount of time and effort that has gone into the front end of doing those experiments is enormous. And in a good way, in that, you know, preparing, for example, for an experiment with, say, worms or tardigrades, or as you were saying, fish, you know, which are in a water media. And then also you could do fruit flies or, you know, other systems which are more in the, or rodents, you know, which are more in the air environment the way humans are. What we do is we actually work on designing the habitats to be very specific for the organism and the system and the experiment that you're doing. So in other words, one, you want to ensure that the model organism that you're using is as comfortable, you know, and healthy and safe as you can make it, because your science goal is to understand what the space environment will do to the organism. You don't want to have them so that they're unhappy for some other reason, right? So as a result, we build those habitats to ensure that, you know, for example, they get food and water at will, so that whenever they need, they can eat, they can drink. We make sure the temperatures are exactly optimal that they thrive in on Earth. Those are the environmental conditions that we recapitulate in space. In terms of light, for example, you know, we know that, and this is true for us humans also, light is very important, because if you don't have the light cycle be matched to our circadian rhythm, it can really throw off your health and physiology. We see that on long flights, you know, when we have jet lag, right? Lighting conditions are important. So we make sure that our habitats are made in such a way that all of these conditions are very well controlled. And then another thing we do is we have the identical setup on Earth as the ground control, so that whatever we're seeing in space, we can compare with an exactly matched control on the ground, where the organism is exposed to exactly the same conditions. And so then that makes for a good scientific comparison. So for these organisms, often, because sometimes they, like the tardigrades or the worms, these are very robust and easy to handle organisms. So what we do is we automate, often we will automate the process of refeeding them. So like fresh media is added, you know, every few days, depending on what the organism needs, directly to the bag. And so you could actually run the experiment for the duration that you want in an automated fashion. In some other instances, maybe it's not so automated and the crew may need to give some food, you know, to the organism periodically. But slowly we're moving more and more to the automated mode. So even for the fruit flies, for example, we now have newer habitats where the food can automatically be given to the fruit flies.
Right. And this might be a simple question, but are the fruit flies able to fly in on the ISS, or are they stationary?
Yeah, you won't imagine how many people have asked me that. Because fruit flies are a flying organism, they are particularly, actually all Earth-based organisms are very sensitive to gravity. But fruit flies, you can imagine, because they're small, light, and they're very handy at flying. So they really sense gravity extremely acutely. So it's interesting. They actually do show differences in their movement and behavior.
I'm guessing maybe they're flying around a little bit more because they don't have the effects of gravity.
You know, it's really interesting. It all depends. So there was an older study done by a Spanish scientist many, many years ago. They did not have a video camera. They only had the regular old analog cameras, right? And so they took snapshots in time and then they tried to map the movements, and then they felt that the flies were hyperactive. And we thought too that yes, but you know, in very weird ways, in that they actually will sometimes tumble as though they're trying to figure out where the gravity vector is. So it is an unusual pattern of movement that they will do. But the interesting thing is, you know, they can reproduce, they will perform all their normal functions.
Are we also doing this to see if our food resources and these animals that are so crucial to our environment here on Earth could live in a different environment as well?
Now, for us, it's not just sufficient to survive. We want to thrive, right? And so our questions are really targeted at what there are subtle changes, just like, you know, if we fly to a new environment, you know, we go to a very, very cold place, you know, all of a sudden there's a big change in climate for us. Our bodies take time to adjust, right? There are changes that occur in our body. It's the same in space. You know, our bodies are used to Earth's environment. And now suddenly you take it to this unusual environment and the body needs to adjust. So our research is focused on one, yes, understanding what are those subtle changes. So we actually take a lot of samples from humans, from astronauts, right? They give blood samples, urine samples, skin, you know, we do skin swabs and look at microbial composition changes. So there's a lot of studies we do with humans, but then there are certain things we cannot ascertain from humans, especially some of the really subtle changes. So think about the fact that, like, when we send a crew of astronauts, you know, there may be a crew of five or a crew of four. And usually, you know, there's men and women. There's some who are older, some who are slightly younger. They're from, you know, different genetic backgrounds. I mean, how you and I will respond, you know, to a novel environment is probably quite different, right, in terms of how our bodies will react. And so it's the same with the astronauts. So for science, it's sometimes hard, especially for the small changes, to really use the human data to understand everything. And so by using these organisms, what it does is it gives us the power of numbers. It gives us the power of reproducibility because you can repeat your experiment a number of times. And it gives you that the genetically identical. So you can have a population of flies that are all genetically identical or mice that are all genetically, you know, from the same you know, genus and species, so that when you see, when you have a small change, let's say in your bone density composition or in your immune system, if you have, you know, 40 identical systems, or let's say thousands of identical fruit flies, you know, siblings, essentially, then you can really get the scientific data for small changes. And that's what we're after, because we need to understand how to counter it. What drugs could we take with us? You know, what drugs could be effective in countering, you know, some of the nausea that maybe an astronaut feels when they get to space? Or how do we counter bone loss, you know, decrements and slow down the loss of bone density or muscle mass, right? So this is the power of using these model organisms to do the science.
Sharmila, thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely.
Still to come, the physical toll on human astronauts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall, in for Brendan Byrne. Before takeoff, astronauts must be in great shape to withstand both the rigors of a space launch and life in microgravity. The Astronaut Strength Conditioning and Rehabilitation, or ASCR group, is a group of physical therapists, athletic trainers, and strength and conditioning professionals who all keep the astronauts healthy before they leave the planet, during their time in space, and once they touch back down on Earth. Here to talk about what it's like to train astronauts is Christy Keeler, a member of the ASCR group. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background and just how you kind of got started in this group and what it's like?
The ASCR group is the Astronaut Strength Conditioning and Rehabilitation Group. It started in the 90s, originally with a strength coach, and then they saw a need for physical readiness involving musculoskeletal care. And so they added athletic trainers. And so that's been the primary two professions that have been in the group since then. Just recently, in the past 2 years, the Air Force has provided a physical therapist, and she works with us as well. So there's four of us currently in the group, two athletic trainers, one strength coach, one physical therapist. The three of us are contractors, and we work for KBR.
So what does a day in the life of a trainer for astronauts look like?
So every day kind of looks different. My background is athletic training, sports medicine. So I'm heavy into the MSK care. And that looks like treating injuries that happen, whether it's like a weekend warrior type thing. A lot of the crew that are coming in, you know, the average age is in the mid-40s. And so when you're in your 40s, stuff starts breaking, even though you're not trying to, but just from age, you know, a lot of the astronauts were in the military. And so that's kind of torn their bodies up over time and just natural aging. So we deal a lot with the MSK, just kind of in general, but then also before flight, in flight, and then post flight. And so that's my core responsibility. We also train all the astronauts, including the international partners, on a device that's called ARED. It's the Advanced Resistive Exercise Device. Each one of those crew members gets 16 one-hour sessions. And so that takes up a good chunk of our time. Reconditioning is another thing that takes up our time. That's post-flight, 45 days, consecutive days of reconditioning with the crew after they come down to rehabilitate them back to their, or as close as we can, back to their normal status. Lots of collaborations with going to the moon. We work with a lot of other groups as far as suits and research, nutrition, bone. And so we're kind of spread across the board everywhere. And then as well as in-flight training. So we write the prescriptions for the treadmill, the cycle, and for ARED as well.
I want to dive in to some of these workouts that the astronauts do. What equipment is available or what is primarily used?
Yeah, for sure. So the devices on station, you have resistance. We just spoke about ARED. You have T2, which is the treadmill, and CVIS, which is the bicycle. And so some people like to run and they don't like to bike or they don't like to lift. And so they kind of have to learn how to utilize these three devices. That's what they're going to have on station for 6 months. And so sometimes it's working with them on programs for that. Particular with the crew that I worked with recently, we've kind of made like a pre-flight ARED training program so that they're used to those lifts that occur on ARED. We're limited on basically the movement. ARED has the largest VIS, which is the vibration isolation system, on station because there's a lot of movement and force that goes through that machine. It goes up to 600 pounds of resistance. So we're teaching them proper technique for squat, deadlift, RDL, bent over row, and a laundry list of exercises, but just making sure that they're comfortable with that, as well as say they have a pre-existing back injury, then we're mitigating that as well, or whatever the case may be that they're dealing with.
How does scheduling and training work before a launch? And do they all do the same workout, or are they different? Do they have preferences?
Yeah, so it's kind of like the general population answer, right? Like one, you know, kind of roadblock that we see with the crew is that they're traveling. They're going to Japan and Russia, Germany, California. So they're kind of all over the place. They don't have the availability to come to the gym and have all these different tools that they can work with here. So we'll make kind of a road workout for them when they're in these different locations so they can accomplish resistance and cardio maintenance. And that looks different for each person because some people like to run, some people like to bike, but we are still incorporating the resistive and cardiovascular endurance no matter where they're going. So that's one thing that we're trying to maintain. It's just a matter of what they prefer and what kind of time and availability they have.
Let's talk about some of the effects of zero gravity on the human body. How do you prevent the effects of zero gravity, muscle deterioration, and the things that we've seen in astronauts previously? What are some ways to prevent that, or exercises?
There's a lot of changes that happen to the body. Historically, it's probably well known that they lose bone density. And so that's our number one goal that we're going after, is to decrease that loss, secondarily muscle loss. So we're working on that strength and trying to maintain that. They can also have a drop in their VO2 max after that kind of 2 week mark into flight. And so we're pushing to increase that cardiovascular endurance and threshold throughout the flight.
What is VO2?
So they're measuring that before flight, in flight, and after flight, just testing their maximum volume of oxygen. They may not work at that max level all the time because that's very difficult. It's not maintainable for a workout, but it just gives us an idea of what they're capable of.
I have heard a lot of astronauts say they land on Earth after being up in space and they say they feel really heavy because they're not used to gravity. Are these goals different for each astronaut when they come back? What does training look like for them when they return? Are they more personalized workouts, I guess you could say?
Yeah, so we have a comprehensive program that kind of looks at all the different systems. So we're looking at that across the board. A lot of neurovestibular, proprioception are probably the number one, and then mobility, or lack of mobility, for the second goal. Strength is usually there. Everybody looks different going up and coming down. They might all work really hard, you know, giving it their best effort. But for whatever reason, some people come down a little stronger than others. Some people have more issues than others. So, you know, there's not like one factor that's going to predict how you're going to react to gravity when you come back down. But it's a generalized comment that they feel heavy. Their legs are heavy, especially when they start running. They're like, I just feel so heavy. And so some people feel resolution as soon as 30 days, and some people feel resolution as far out as 6 months. And so there's not a blanket answer really for all of them. Everybody, it's pretty individualized.
What is it like training people who are flying into space? Do you connect with these astronauts on a deeper level because you are their trainer?
That's a great question. So actually, I got a rare opportunity to come here and work during the shuttle days. And so that was my first experience. And it was great to get to know the crew. Even back then, everybody was just really down to earth, great, you know, open to, you know, any kind of help or resource that they could get from the group. And then coming back, I came back in 22. It's another great group. Everybody's down to earth. Everybody's open, you know, for insight. It's great to have that kind of patient population. You know, you build the trust with them and they will come back when there's an issue to deal with. And so they're normal people just like everybody else. Sometimes it's, you know, there's nothing that sets them apart, you know, from just working in a generalized like physical therapy clinic. They're great people. They're getting great outcomes. They're great patients. When patients have you know, issues that you're working with, and a lot of them are chronic, you're getting a lot of time together, you know, and so you get to know each other, and, you know, you miss them when they fly in space for 6 months and they're not down here on the ground. But it's a cool experience. And then we get to make up on that time when they come back down with 45 days of reconditioning. But yeah, you do, you know, kind of naturally, organically build relationships and get to know each other over the years.
You said 45 days once they return. Do some astronauts need more workouts and physical therapy than others? And what happens after that 45-day period?
Yeah, so we're attacking all the systems of the body throughout the whole training process. Some people respond a little faster to some than others. So we're working on range of motion, specifically in the spine and in the hips. We see a decrease in that. We're looking at core strength and activating those deep muscles of the back and the abdominals that didn't have to really fight gravity, so they weren't really functioning to their full capability in microgravity. We're looking at cardiovascular strength, muscular strength, proprioception, so balance, a lot of closed, you know, eyes closed type balance. A lot of the patients are really vision dependent. And it's easy to see when we, you know, we get them doing a single leg balance 15 seconds and they're great. And then you close their eye or they close their eyes and they're all over the place. And so that tells us what we need to work on.
Why close their eyes? Is that something you look at post-flight?
Yeah. So say we had them do a single leg stand. So they're just standing on one leg for 15 seconds and they have no touches. They're solid. They're not swaying. And then we have them do the same thing with their eyes closed. And maybe they're swaying, they're losing their balance, they're having touches with the opposite foot. Then we know they are dependent on their vision to keep their balance. So that's when we say that they're vision dependent.
Okay, so once they're done and back on Earth, can they still have access to these workouts? And if so, I also want access to these workouts. Can you work with them remotely as well?
Yeah, so we are evaluating that in post-flight. That's a great question. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell pre-flight, even just general population. You can see most people are probably going to be affected by that. But when they come back, it's pretty obvious on, you know, what systems that we need to kind of exercise. And we do a weekly screening, and so we're tracking their progress every week. And that screening also tells us, like, hey, they mastered this, and now we really need to focus all of our energy on this one system. Kind of looks different for each person, depending on their cardiovascular and muscular endurance and strength. Sometimes we'll kind of deal with some nagging MSK issues that maybe popped up post-flight, and so we'll do some extra sessions for that. But everybody's different. So after the 45 days, shortly after, they'll start their kind of post tours, like public affairs activities. And so that takes them away physically from this location. But we have other ways that we can work with them. And so we're able to keep in touch with them to send them workouts if they would like that, or any kind of goals that they're shooting for. We're here as a resource to help them to get to that goal.
Well, Christy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been so fun.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our host is Brennan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summer. Our intern is Alessandra Boniuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Marion Summerall. Thanks for listening.